In the region. This RCEP, Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, is the world's largest trading bloc, accounting for one-third of the world's economy and one-third of the world's population. But unfortunately, India is not has chosen not to be part of it. And China is right at the heart of this regional regional comprehensive economic partnership, trading bloc. In the sense that China is the center of the regional supply and value chain. China, of course, is the largest trading partner, not only in the region, but in the world. It's the largest manufacturer. It's a huge internal market. So China's got all these strings. And the jury is still out on whether India or China in Sri Lanka.
So, Mr. Leung, both India and China have their own interests in the South Asian island country. So how much is this debt trap diplomacy going to affect the sovereignty of Sri Lanka?
Sri Lanka still remains very jealous of its own sovereignty. And it's, even with all these loans from India, Sri Lanka remains relatively a little bit suspicious of the reversion of reoccurrence of India's hegemony over India over Sri Lanka, but I think that in recent years, all ASEAN countries, in fact, all most of the developing world, are very conscious of their own sovereignty. No country wants to be under another country's thumb. But nevertheless, the reality remains that they. All countries depend on the economy, and the economy depends on the world trade and also foreign investments. And China, of course, is the largest trader and it's also the largest foreign source of source of foreign investment. And as I said, with the Belt and Road linking the whole world together to the global and supply to its global supply and value chain, as the world's largest trader and manufacturer and the world's largest consumer market. So China's got all the advantages.
Last but not least, sir, following New Delhi, Beijing has given financing assurance to Sri Lanka for the IMF bailout package. So do you think Sri Lanka will come out of this economic crisis anytime soon?
Well, the India's lending to Sri Lanka recently is also depending on the IMF bailout. But the as experienced by many developing countries around the world, the IMF bailout comes with a lot of conditions, imposed on their own governance, the system, make the system much more open to outside influence or outside investments, then some countries are prepared to concede. So it remains to be seen whether Sri Lanka would embrace all the conditions in order to accept this bailout. And then the willingness of Sri Lanka's acceptance of the IMF conditions would also affect its future, the ease with which Indians attempt to recover its influence in Sri Lanka. So it all depends on what the IMF bailout would be, what the conditions are, and to what extent the Sri Lankan government is prepared to accept those conditions.
There you have it, Mr. Andrew K.P. Leung, an international and independent China strategist from Hong Kong. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Wang Xiaoyan, the spokesperson of the Chinese embassy in India, writes, China stands ready to work with relevant countries and international financial institutions and continue to play a positive role in helping Sri Lanka navigate the situation, easing its debt burden and helping it achieve sustainable development. One of the Indian news channels tweeted, on close ties with China, Foreign Minister Ali Sabri said Sri Lanka has never undermined India's interests and will not allow anyone else to threaten India's security concerns. Dr. R. De Silva says, another Western competing view of foreign interference in Sri Lanka and on the behavior and motives of the IMF. views we must consider include the West, Africa, China, Russia, and India. Imperative is, however, the effects on the well-being of Sri Lankans. Sidhant Sibal, a journalist, said, days after India announced its support for Sri Lanka's debt restructuring, China rushed to extend support. Sri Lankan media reports says government in Colombo rather disappointed with Chinese letter and Beijing's response fell short of what was expected.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The Pakistani government and the Russian energy minister Nikolai Shulginov, who was in Islamabad just recently for an annual intergovernmental commission on trade and economy, said the key elements of the energy deal between the two countries will be finalized by March this year. Pakistan and Russia have also agreed to strengthen their ties in the areas of energy cooperation, enhancing energy trade, and also to broaden energy infrastructure investment. According to the two sides, comprehensive gas infrastructure plan for energy cooperation is going to be the stepping stone for future deals between Moscow and Islamabad, with other things remaining the same.
Pakistan is going to be Russia's new energy partner. The two sides have agreed to pay for the energy purchases in the currencies of the friendly countries. The announcement was made at the conclusion of the 8th session of the Pakistan-Russia Intergovernmental Commission, IGC, on Trade, Economic, Scientific and Technical Cooperation, which took place last week in Islamabad. The friendly country is likely to be China, which shares good relations with both Russia and Pakistan. This move is expected to affect the monopoly of the dollar as being the reserve currency of the world. Countries like China, Iran, Russia, and Venezuela have already done trade deals in local currencies, thus challenging the hegemony of the U.S. dollar.
De-dollarization is certainly the way to go. I don't know exactly how Russia and Pakistan plan to proceed payments, but I'm sure a way will be found. And let me remind you that just last year, Iran has signed a deal with China. Iran will supply huge amounts of oil to China, worth probably of billions of dollars, $300 billion. This amount was mentioned. Obviously, Pakistan and China found a way to make payments for this oil. And obviously, these payments are not going to be made in dollars because Iran has been switched off from the SWIFT system under pressure from the United States. So we know the story. Obviously, if Iran found a way to trade oil with China and to get payment for it without dollars, then probably the same solution can be found between Russia and Pakistan, even though it was not immediately clear how this deal will be proceeded with financially.
Pakistan officials had visited Moscow last year to explore the possibility of the import of crude oil from Russia on discounted rates. After a series of talks, the two countries agreed that the import of crude oil to the cash-stripped South Asian country will take place from March this year. Both Moscow and Islamabad acknowledged the importance of this growing relationship for the economic progress of both the countries and also of the region.
That Russia is going to conclude with Pakistan. If everything works out, then according to the information of the Russian energy minister, Mr. Shulginov, Russia will be able to supply 35% of Pakistan's needs in crude oil. This is a lot. And of course, Iran could also participate in this process of providing oil and energy to Pakistani industry. I don't know in what state the pipeline is, which should connect Iran and Pakistan. This is for the Iranian side, maybe, to clarify. But Russia would have nothing against the joint efforts of Russia and Iran in supplying for the needs of developing countries. Pakistan is a country that we have a friendly relationship now with. There was a period in the Soviet times when Pakistan became a sort of an agent of the United States. It was under the dictatorial regime of Ziaul Haq. But that was long ago. Times have changed. Now we know very well that Pakistani people have a positive view of Russia. They view Russia as an ally. They're very much angry with the United States after the drone war and other cruelties that Americans have committed against Pakistanis.
Pakistan's foreign exchange reserves have depleted to about $4.6 billion, barely enough to cover a month's oil imports. In this situation, Islamabad has decided to buy oil at discounted rates from Moscow to protect its deteriorating financial situation. To defend this move, the country has cited India's example, which has been buying oil from Russia for a long time now. This deal appears to be a win-win situation for both the countries, as Pakistan would want to be a part of the regional bloc that has Moscow and Beijing as its important members, and in turn, Russia's close ties with Islamabad will have an impact on the security and strategic stability in the region.
Historically, Pakistan did not share close commercial ties with Russia. Islamabad has been dependent for oil on the Persian Gulf countries, especially Saudi Arabia and the UAE. However, this trend seems to be changing with Pakistan's announcement that the country is intending to fulfill 35% of its crude oil imports through Russia. Getting Russian oil will reduce the market share of the Arab countries and may also have an impact on the diplomatic and trade relations Islamabad shares with these countries.
Well, Persian Gulf countries understand that this is the market. Everyone is looking for customers. Everyone is looking for markets. Russia did not protest when Germany decided to replace Russian gas on its market by gas from Qatar. We have nothing against it. This is market. However, I would say that it was very stupid of Germany to insult Qataris during their soccer, during the football World Cup in Qatar, by constantly mentioning the theme of homosexuals living in Qatar. Germany should be busy with its own affairs. It should not insult other countries, especially those who invited with its shitty team to the international sports events. So I think sooner or later, European countries will become unwanted clients for Persian Gulf states, simply because Europeans are getting so rude and unbearable in diplomatic ties.
It is important to mention that this development comes at a time when the G7 countries are scheduled to meet in March to review the price cap on exports of Russian oil. The growing bonhomie between Russia and Pakistan can be a cause of concern for the West, also because of Islamabad's strategic location in the region. Having signed agreements for cooperation in the customs and aviation sector as well, thus improving relations between the two countries, is worrying for the U.S. and its allies, as it will probably allow Russia to challenge the presence of NATO in one of the world's most strategic zones.
Well, I don't think we need military aid from Pakistan, because Russia can defend itself on its own. We don't need, any weapons from Muslim countries which suffered from Western aggressions. And to my mind, what happened in Pakistan between 2001, when the United States occupied Afghanistan, and 2021, I think it was terrible. It was, Pakistan suffered almost as severely as Afghanistan during the bombings, during the drone attacks. So this is all over, thank God. Now, if Pakistan understands our fight, why we're defending ourselves from NATO, fine. We'll be happy to get diplomatic support. We'll be happy if Pakistan supports us politically. But I have not heard about any weapons supplies or any kind of military aid that we would require from Pakistan.
Now, let's see what people have to say on the latest deal between Russia and Pakistan for the import of crude oil to the energy-starved country.
Tweeting about the currency, Santelets wrote, Russia and Pakistan conclude an oil deal that will be settled in national currencies. Soon, no one will want to transact in U.S. dollars. Abdul Rahman, an investor, said, Russia hints at Pakistan-Russia crude oil deal tentatively from March 2023. Most probably, Chinese yuan will be used for payment. Two important details still awaited. Pricing, discount, volume, 50 to 100,000 barrels per day would be great for Pakistan. Edek tweeted, Russia and Pakistan agree major energy deal. Oil and gas exports from the sanctions-hit country will help the world's fifth most populous nation meet its demands.
And that was our episode about the Russia-Pakistan changing relation dynamics and its impact on world politics. And also, Sri Lanka's economic crisis with India and China competing to gain foothold in the island country. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. I have a very special guest speaker for today's discussion, Shaykh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It might happen that in the lives of the believers and mu'mineen all across the world, whether they are Muslims or Christian or Jews, some doubts or misunderstanding happens in their religious beliefs. And especially in the modern age, we can say if the atheist attacks with the agnostic attacks to the religions, these doubts and the number of doubts are increasing. Is it at all good for the people, ordinary people, in order to learn religious knowledge, to be aware of the answers to such questions, or no? They must refer to an alim or a scholar to get their answers on such new doubts and questions.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we're talking about religious knowledge, in our case Islamic knowledge, it's a vast spectrum of different fields of studies. I mean, when we're talking Islamic studies, especially nowadays, we have different fields. It can be theology, philosophy, Islamic laws.
Hadith, Quran.
Yeah, exactly, yes. All these. And so the point is that, is it necessary for all the Muslims to go deep and spend many years learning all these fields of studies? Of course, the answer is negative because, in that case, we would have lack of other scholars in other scientific fields. So the point is that, to some extent, all the people are obliged, according to the religion of Islam, to know about the religion. So, for example, when it comes to especially the fundamental beliefs like belief in God, belief in the prophets, and the Day of Judgment, according to all Shia scholars, no one is allowed to follow other people, even great scholars. No.
Yes.
For you to be a monotheist, you may think, you may ponder, you may look for arguments, rational arguments, and in some cases maybe narrated arguments. To prove the existence of God, for example, the prophethood of different prophets, especially our prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, and then to prove the authenticity of the Quran, and then through Quran you may also prove the Day of Judgment, and so on and so forth.
That's right.
And when it comes to the Islamic laws, the Sharia, again, to some extent, people need to, learn the Islamic laws that they are in need of. This is mentioned in all the books of Tawdih al-Masail, the Islamic laws, that people need to know at least the laws that, they are dealing with on a daily basis, for example, yes. or on a weekly basis. So, for example, for prayer, for fasting, for khums, zakat, we need to at least know the general rulings.
Yes.
And then if you are a merchant, for example, yes. you need to know the laws of that specific, business, for example.
That's right. All businesses, we can say, and transactions in Islam are under the shadow of Islamic laws. As a Muslim, you have to be aware of them, okay?
Yeah.
But the modern day has made it very much complicated, Sheikh, you know? We can say new doubts, new types of transactions come into the scene. And the questions now are increasing a lot, up to an extent that some people, for example, give priority to the doubt and leave an obligation. This happens a lot in the lives of believers too nowadays.
Yeah. That's a very good question. Thank you for sharing that. Before answering your question, so my point is that to some extent, when it comes to religious knowledge, especially about the beliefs, about Islamic laws, and sometimes about moral issues, all the people have this obligation to know about and to learn those specific types of knowledge. But when we're talking about deducing the Islamic laws from the sources, then it's not the obligation of all the people.
Yes.
And there is a very explicit verse in this regard in chapter At-Tawbah, verse 122. It is interesting to know that this verse was revealed when there was the time for a war, and some Muslims, the majority of the Muslims, were ready to go to that war.
Yes.
But then this verse was revealed. وَمَا كَانَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ لِيَنْفِرُوا كَافَّةً. It is not for all the people, all the believers, to go forth altogether, meaning for war.
Yes.
فَلَوْلَا نَفَرَ مِنْ كُلِّ فِرْقَةٍ مِّنْهُمْ طَائِفَةٌ لِيَتَفَقَّهُ فِي الدِّينِ. But why should not there a group from each of their sections go forth to become learned in religion? وَلِيُنذِرُوا قَوْمَهُمْ إِذَا رَجَعُوا إِلَيْهِمْ. And to warn their people when they return to them so that they may be aware. So that they may beware. لَعَلَّهُمْ يَحْذَرُونَ. So this is a very interesting verse in that even at the time of war, Islam says that at least in many occasions, it's not the duty of all the Muslims to, leave the schools, the universities, I'm talking about our time and era, and go to war. No, we need people, some people going to, special schools to study the religion. So this is what we mean by wajib kifayi, meaning that an obligation upon some people.
Yes.
So when it comes to deducing the Islamic laws from the sources, it is the duty of, some people, and that is the reason we have all these Islamic seminaries, hawzas, and the great scholars who spend all their life in learning about all these different types and fields of Islamic studies. So this is their duty, and then the duty of other people who are not that learned, like in Islamic studies, is to follow these great scholars. And that is the whole philosophy of taqlid, or
That's
following.
Right.
Because all the people do not have enough time to spend their whole lifetime to study about Islamic studies, which is a vast knowledge. It's not only Quran and Hadith.
Yes.
No, there are many fields of studies, like even Arabic grammar, Arabic syntax, Rijal, Diraya, mm-hmm. logic, philosophy, and so on and so forth. So for that, either they need to be a mujtahid, a person who is able
yes.
to deduce Islamic laws from the
okay.
sources, or they need to act upon ihtiyat or precaution, which is very difficult, which means that, for example, if a scholar says that under this situation, you need to say a 2-rak'ah prayer. Another scholar says that, no, you need to say a 4-rak'ah prayer, like in a journey. Then acting upon precaution means that you need to do both, which is very difficult, and in some cases it's not possible.
That's right.
So, and the third option is to follow a mujtahid,
okay.
the more learned one, and the other conditions which are mentioned.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
And beside mujtahids, you know, there are so many scholars, as you said, nowadays at the universities who are interested in a specific field of study. For example, we can say those people who are working on Mahdism, Mahdaviyat, okay? We can say there are so many doubts and questions regarding that point. There are some specific researchers who dedicated their life to that point, or Karbala history, or, for example, the history of Islam, or this and that. I say even up to an extent that a mujtahid might not be able to answer those questions, but those people are, you know, it is a duty, as you say, of a Muslim to refer to such people to get the answer. But unfortunately, because of lack of time, you know, the engagement with different cases, the priority now is given to the doubts, and people are living with the doubts every day.
That's a very good point. Before going to the doubts, I mean, you refer to professors coming from the university. That's a very good point, and thank you for sharing that. You know, unlike some other religions, which believe that religious knowledge should be limited to, I mean, religious circles, I mean, like, for example, the churches and other people have no right to even read the Bible, at least from the viewpoint of Shia scholars, it's not like that. I mean, it doesn't mean that it is only the right of the people coming from the houses, from the seminaries to, I mean, go into the Islamic studies and become experts so that other people may refer to them. No, the gate is open to all the people.
Yes.
And some people, without joining the Islamic seminaries, they, I mean, try their best to, I mean, deeply read the Islamic studies, I mean, go into the Islamic studies.
Yes.
Many people coming from the universities, because nowadays in some countries, especially in Islamic Republic of Iran, we have a special fields in some universities which also teach the same content.
Yes.
Although, still, I believe that even the listeners agree that in most of the cases, people coming from the seminaries, they may be preferred in from some dimensions because of the fact that they spend all their lives for this type of knowledge.
And there is a third group, the people who are from religious roots but attend the universities. I mean, that's right, something between the two. So, there are so many centers, for example, nowadays in Islamic Republic, we're not ready to answer the doubts and questions, okay, on religion.
So my point is that we cannot limit the knowledge to any circle, any school, excluding other institutions. No, the gate is open for all the people. Now, regarding all these doubts that they are raised nowadays, unfortunately, of course, having doubts is not an unfortunate phenomenon in and of itself. But the point is that many people, unfortunately, they just read the doubts and they do not refer to the scholars for finding the answers to the doubts. And the other point about this doubt is that when you see, a post is shared in social media, there is only, like, there are only 10 lines, but 20 doubts are mentioned in these 10 lines. About the history of Islam, about theology, about politics, and so on and so forth. So many questions in one post, and people are, I mean, attacked by, are bombarded by all these different various doubts. But then for a scholar to answer all these, like, only 10 questions, he's in need of, I mean, like, 30 pages.
Yes.
And no person has enough time, and it doesn't feel like going through all these 30 pages, and it makes it a bit complicated.
That's right.
I mean, people have access to the doubts, but they do not feel like finding and reading the answers.
That's right.
But the point is that, I mean, doubt in and of itself is not something bad.
Okay.
But we should not stay on this condition. As soon as you receive a doubt, you need to ask the scholars to know about it.
Okay.
if you do not have the opportunity, then stop reading such books.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, either you need to be able to answer yourself.
Yes.
That is why you're spending time to read all these doubts. Otherwise, if you're not such a person, you need to find a scholar who is able to answer. And alhamdulillah, in all the cases, we have, I mean, enough scholars, many scholars, and convincing answer. You cannot find any unanswered misunderstanding and doubt. But the point is that almost in all the cases, the answers are much, much more lengthier than the questions, right, and the doubts.
And sometimes, you know, the cases with the scholars we are referring to, incapability in order to answer properly to the questions. This is the case, yeah, too. For example, you know, the people has a doubt regarding Imam Mahdi or this or that, the Holy Quran, whether the text was a miracle or not. They refer to the person who is not able to answer them properly.
Mm-hmm.
So the best answer is the simple answer, okay? The best answer is the improper answer. The best answer is the incomplete answer. They got it, and for example, they leave an obligation. That's why the duty of, I believe, is on the shoulders of our scholars too, to make themselves great again, to achieve, and to study a lot, you know? This is the case.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And also, let me add to that that, first of all, people should not expect all the people coming from seminaries, mm-hmm, to know all the answers to all the questions.
That's right.
We have so many fields of studies, and we need, yes, expert in each field. And second of all, for people coming from the seminary, they should also should not think that they know everything.
Yes.
So sometimes if, I mean, as a religious scholars, as a clergyman, people come to you asking questions on theology or philosophy, but,
yes,
you are an expert in Islamic laws, for example, then you may not, I mean, it would be much better if you refrain, if you avoid answering, instead introducing other people who are expert in that field of study.
That's right.
But my point is that, alhamdulillah, nowadays, with the, blessings of the Islamic Republic of Iran and many other seminaries in Lebanon, Syria,
yes,
Iraq, and so,
okay,
on and so forth, we cannot find any question,
yes,
which is not answered, at,
yes,
least in three languages,
right,
Persian, Arabic, English, and in many cases, Urdu,
okay,
languages.
Yes.
So the answers are available,
yes,
but it is the duty of the people,
yes,
who, I mean, are faced with these doubts to find the answers,
yes,
and look for the answers.
Okay. The socio-political and the financial problems also of a country might overshadow, I would say, the religious concepts.
Mm-hmm.
So on such cases, I think referring to the scholars and ulama might help again.
Sure.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration regarding this topic. And thank you very much to the listeners for listening to this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Imam Khomeini's viewpoint on condition of leadership. Allah the Exalted had appointed the Prophet Muhammad as the wali or leader for all Muslims, and as long as he was alive, he had control over even Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam. When the Prophet passed away, Imam Ali also had control over all Muslims, even over the next Imam. It means that his governmental commands should have been obeyed by all, and he was able to appoint and dispose local rulers. Just as the Prophet Muhammad was charged with implementing rules and establishing the Islamic system, and Allah had made him leader and ruler of Muslims and considered submission to him as mandatory, a just jurist should also be leader and ruler, apply divine rules, and endeavor to set the Islamic social system up.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, dear brothers and sisters. This is Ali, and we're going to talk about one of the statements of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh and Imam's viewpoints with regard to the government and the importance of the governments and the goals of the governments. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh says that the ruler of Islamic government and the head of the Islamic state never fears from people because he's not a traitor. He is from the people. We said earlier that Imam, as an Islamic ruler, gave too much attention, too much value to the importance of the role of the people in a government. And now Imam actually tells the Islamic rulers and Islamic statesmen that, or the head of the governments, that you are not going to be fearing, you don't need to fear from the people, because people are from you and you are from them. Here in these words, actually, Imam wants to say that why should you, for example, hide something from your own people, except some issues that, for example, are due to some security issues and are not allowed to be said to, in public. But all the issues and the problems of the country should be consulted with the people, with the nation. That is, the Islamic ruler or the head of the government is not thinking, is not looking at the people as strangers in his own society.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi, sallallahu alayhi.
People are going to work like an arm for this body. If we think of the government as a body, people are going to be working like the arm of this body. So an Islamic ruler should not be separate from the people and should not be fearing from people. He has to feel a sort of coziness with his own people and tell them everything and take their own viewpoints and actually implement whatever it is he's taking from them. Is it decent to do so, for example, to involve people in all the issues and affairs? Definitely, yes. How and what is the procedure to do so is something that needs to be discussed, inshallah, in upcoming sessions.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every day, never forget to say. economic divide.
The U.S. is in a recession. The U.S. is not in a recession. The U.S. will be in a recession. So, what is the deal? Well, some say that it is already. Others say that it will be in this year, 2023. And then, some others are predicting a soft landing. So, which one of these scenarios will be the case? That's what we're going to find out in this edition of Economic Divide, because the U.S. economy going into a recession does matter for its impact on the world economy. Some of the highlights of this program coming up is the U.S. recession for the year 2023. The odds, 70% demand forecasts have been slashed and inflation projections have been trimmed. All the signs that the U.S. will be in a recession for the year 2023. Some of the highlights there of that particular topic. Then we move on to GDP growth, another highlight. It's been said to average a paltry 0.3% only. Consumer spending will barely grow, and that accounts for two-thirds of the GDP in the U.S. Don't forget that. And another highlight coming up in this program, recession factors that we called it. Well, you have surging interest rates, you have high inflation, another sign of recession, and also the end of fiscal stimulus and weak export markets all contribute to recession. The U.S. economy is going through a tough time. Economists say there is a 7 in 10 likelihood that the U.S. economy will sink into a recession this year. There are now worries that the economy may be heading towards a more pronounced slowdown. According to surveys, the recession probability was up from 65% in November and has more than doubled over the last 6 months. That's mainly due to last year's aggressive rate hikes by the Federal Reserve. Believe several factors are involved here: surging interest rates, high inflation, the end of fiscal stimulus, and weak export markets abroad have all contributed to the weakening of the U.S. economy. Officials at the Federal Reserve say that they will hike rates more than they initially expected over time. That is because officials want to tame the rising levels of inflation. Inflation readings from the UK and the Eurozone also factored into fears of an economic slowdown. Meanwhile, released data show that US retail sales fell by the most in a year in December, pulled down by declines in purchases of motor vehicles and a range of other goods. That puts consumer spending and the overall economy on a weaker growth path heading into 2023. Now that 2023 is here, it remains to be seen when the recession is actually going to hit.
We are seeing a slowing in the economy and in demand that's appropriate and necessary to transition from rapid growth and recovery from a serious job shortfall to now a very strong labor market. We need to see a slowdown in growth. We are seeing that. I do believe there's a path by which we maintain a strong labor market like that.
It's time now for the social media posts of this program. I'm not going to lie to you. Practically most of the posts that we went through, almost every other one, said that the U.S. was in a recession by the end of 2022 and that for the year 2023 it will definitely be in one. So let's get started. First post: in the U.S., high inflation and aggressively hiking interest rates caused looming recession in 2022. What will the economy be like in 2023? The Economist warns the risk of a recession in the U.S. Economy will be high. Next up, a 60-40 portfolio of U.S. stocks and bonds in 2022 would have yielded the worst performance in a century. The U.S. will have a huge recession in 2023. Americans are so clueless, though, supporting a proxy war against Russia. Next post: every U.S. recession has been preceded by at least one of the following: oil shock, inverted yield curve, Fed tightening cycle. The year 2022 had all three. Then, the six-month rate of change of the leading economic index has a perfect track record of forecasting recessions. Says the LEI indicator tells us that a recession is right here, right now. And then finally, in answer to the previous tweet, we picked this one, which said we met the definition of a recession after the first two quarters. Our energy exports are the main driving force behind a positive third quarter. We are in a recession, but it is being masked. Okay, so it's being masked. Let's find out what our guest thinks about this. Let me see who we have. We have David Hungerford, an author and economist, who joins us as a first guest here on Economic Divide. David Hungerford, welcome to the program. So let's take a look at the prediction, 70% prediction that the U.S. will experience a full recession for the year 2023. Economists are predicting a 70% chance of that happening. That's according to the latest survey that Bloomberg gave out. Do you agree with Bloomberg? Do you think that based on the stats, the U.S. will be in a recession for the year 2023?
How are we doing? Okay, well, the United States already is in a recession. It's been fobbed off as a pandemic. But in fact, you know, the United States went into a rather serious recession in Q1 2020. And at that time, the cause was an enormous overburden of household debt, you know, mortgages, student debt, credit card loans, car loans. It was over $16 trillion, which comes out to, you know, around, you know, $200,000 of debt, household debt per family in the United States, roughly speaking. You know, whereas the median household gross income is only $69,000. And it's simply impossible to carry, you know, $200,000 of debt against, you know, gross income of $69,000.
All right. Let me introduce our next guest. We have Robert Bruska, who joins us. He is a chief economist at Fact and Opinion Economist. Robert Bruska, welcome to Economic Divide. The median estimates see gross domestic product averaging just 0.3% next year, which includes a annualized 0.7% decline in terms of the figures we have for the second quarter. And then you have flat readings for the first and third quarters. Consumer spending, which accounts for about two-thirds of the GDP, that's a huge chunk, is projected to barely grow in the middle half of the year, this year that we're in. Why would the U.S., the world's alleged number one economy, experience such paltry numbers?
Yeah, I think a recession is coming. I think the percentages are, you know, roughly what you'd expect from economists at this point. Some of the early data, even over this past week, have been quite disturbing, with personal consumption expenditures declining for the second month in a row, and with an extremely weak reading out of the Fed survey for manufacturing in the New York region, and another relatively weak one out of the Philadelphia region. It looks like the economy is headed for recession. But so far, it's also true that it has not affected the job market. The unemployment rate remains at a cycle low. Jobless claims this last week went down by 200,000, which is an extremely low level. And so we continue to get very mixed signals on the economy. Some things saying that the economy is getting very weak, and other things saying the economy is almost unaffected.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of the program. This section, obviously, is dedicated to news that we gather from around the world that we deem to be important. We pick four of them. First off, in a subject that is somewhat related to this program, not somewhat, it is very much related to this program, and it's about layoffs in the United States, and in particular, tech layoffs. Tech for technology, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and other tech companies have laid off more than 70,000 employees for the last year. Layoffs come as tech companies are cutting back on spending, and also rising inflation is curbing consumer spending. So this particular topic, just so you know, is so vast in its impact, we decided to actually dedicate a program to it, which will be coming up probably in a couple weeks' time, so do watch out for that. Taking a look now at the next topic, EU-China relations. In particular, we're looking at a stance that France actually took when it comes to China, where he said China cannot be out China must be in. France is saying that it's diverging with the U.S. on ties with Beijing. The United States has taken a confrontational approach, how France sees it, and a lot of other people in countries. Well, the EU has looked at striking a balance when it comes to China. The French President Emmanuel Macron has said, we don't want to oppose China, we want to engage with China. We want China to obey by the same rules. I'll have to wait and see how that pans out, but it looks like the EU wants to obviously keep that relationship going. The topic that comes up next is something that we have focused on quite a bit. It's called de-dollarization, and this comes from Saudi Arabia, where it said they are now open to the idea of trading in currencies besides the U.S. dollar. And the headline read, does this spell doom for the greenback? Because it's the first time in 48 years that Saudi Arabia has said something like that. Now, Saudi Arabia's comments are the latest signal that powerful nations across the world are actually moving ahead, maybe based on this particular piece of news that says it's plotting. Well, countries are moving ahead with a de-dollarization of the global economy. I'm not too sure plotting would be the word, because if it is, then it shows that this has been in the works for quite some time, which is very well possible. And finally, our topic comes out of the U.S., where there have been lots of bankruptcies that have been reported, U.S. lender bankruptcies in particular, where lenders are starting to go bankrupt with the new mortgages, which is a signal, now down 47%. And the question now arises, could this one factor trigger the worst surge of failures since the 2008 financial crisis? You have new mortgages that were down 47% in the third quarter of 2022 compared to the year before. And that is the biggest annual drop in 21 years. Those four topics were what we picked for this section of our program called Info News. Please do send us your ideas or topics related to the economy. We would appreciate it very much.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for our in-depth section of the program. Now, in this section, we need to take a look at the U.S. economy in terms of different factors that we deemed important relative to other economies around the world, which is another focus of this in-depth section, but also as to why we are saying that the possibility of a recession is actually here for the U.S., especially in this new year. Now, first up, let's take a look at recessions in the U.S. That have happened in the past. I mean, it's worth taking a look at these recessions and how long they lasted in the U.S. Now, according to how we define a recession, the U.S. did experience a recession back in the year 2022, last year, since it experienced two consecutive quarters of GDP contraction. Now, in February of 2020, and of course, the relative times. Next, in terms of the recession for the year 2023, now, this is why we even came up with this program. Economists are saying that there is a 7 in 10 likelihood that the U.S. economy will sink into a recession for this year. From June until now, the odds of the U.S. being in a recession have grown. This is for the year 2022 in terms of the surveys that they took, and that month after month has increased. Now, because of this projection, obviously it has had its ripple effects. For example, CEOs, they have been on the move. About 39% of the CEOs have actually implemented a hiring freeze, while 46%, well, they are considering downsizing their employee base during the next 6 months. So for the next 6 months of this year, that's what's going to be happening. Now, another estimate that we took a look at is a gross domestic product. Well, for the U.S., it's averaging a paltry 0.3% next year based on the projections that have been made. That includes an annualized 0.7% decline in the second quarter, and also flat readings in the first and third quarters. So things are not looking that great based on those indicators. Now, in the meantime, consumer spending, that's important to take a look at. Consumer spending accounts for about two-thirds of the U.S. GDP. That is projected to barely grow. And when it's going to grow, well, the projection is in the middle half of this year, so another 6 months to go. And then finally, here are some raw indicators visualized in one lump sum. U.S. savings, the lowest since the year 2008, 4.4%. It has decreased. Crypto losses, $2 trillion. Ouch, that hurts. Taking a look at credit card debt at 20%, you're looking at about $1 trillion for U.S. households. I think that averages roughly about $200,000 per household or so. Then inflation standing at 10% as of now, and then mortgage rates, which have doubled. Let's find out what our guests think about this. First up, we'll bring back David Hungerford. He's an author and economist. David Hungerford, welcome back to Economic Divide. So we just went over some indicators for the U.S., but the U.S. is facing big headwinds when you take a look at interest rates, high inflation, the end of fiscal stimulus, weak export markets abroad, just some. Businesses have turned cautious about adding inventories and also about their hiring. When do you think things are going to turn around for the U.S.?
I don't think any end is in sight. The economic difficulties that you mentioned are by no means confined to the United States. I think every developed industrial economy in the world is in this shape. I think China's in terrible shape also. They've had these lockdowns, you know. Lockdowns always stand for keeping people under control in the face of economic crisis. So you have, we're looking at something that's very widespread around the world. And at this point, I would say that no end is in sight.
All right. Very well. Thank you for that. Let me now bring back our guest, Robert Bruska, who's the chief economist, the fact and opinion economist, who rejoins us. Robert Bruska, welcome back. The U.S. economy is facing a lot of challenges. Interest rates is one of them. You have high inflation, which is still not seen cooling down, even though there have been some signs that it is. But the end of fiscal stimulus is set to be another problem. And, of course, the exports. I mean, you have countries that rely on U.S. exports, and that's not happening from the U.S., based on factory production declining also. When do you think things are going to turn around for the U.S.?
Right. Well, these are all the classic symptoms that you have or characteristics that you have as the economy goes into recession and spends time in recession. And, nobody ever knows how long a recession is going to be. An average recession is probably something less than a year. We've had them much longer than that. How long this one is depends on how the Fed chooses to fight inflation. There are some people at the Fed who want the Fed to raise interest rates more sharply and to push inflation back down relatively quickly. However, there are other people who think that the Fed needs to slow down to keep interest rates about where they are, and then to hold interest rates at the level that they are now for a longer period of time and to slowly grind inflation down. So the grind inflation down path will be one that will cause the economy to underperform for a longer period of time. If we have higher interest rates in the near term, it's more likely that we'll have a somewhat sharper recession and that we will reduce inflation more quickly.